3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Alarm is raised over U.S. airport security. A recent audit of the U.S. Transportation Security Administration found the agency failed to identify more than 70 workers with links to terrorism. It concluded the agency's multi-layered process for screening aviation workers was generally effective, but the agency doesn't have access to a terror watch list information. John Roth is the Homeland Security Department's Inspector General.
While we applaud the concept of risk-based approach in transportation security, our audits and inspections have uncovered significant vulnerabilities, and we have deep concerns regarding the manner in which TSA manages this risk.
The audit found thousands of records used for investigating works had incomplete or inaccurate information. The report comes days after an internal report found that airport checkpoint screeners failed to detect fake explosives and weapons in most of the tests carried out by undercover federal agents. Libya's internationally recognized parliament has expressed unhappiness over a proposed national unity government advanced by the UN and mediated talks with the rival Islamist-dominated government in Tripoli. The latest plan, unveiled during talks Monday with the two sides of Morocco, is aimed at ending 4 years of chaos following the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Jeff Rathke is a U.S. spokesman.
It is our understanding that the Libyan delegations from both the House of Representatives and the former General National Congress are on their way to Berlin for additional meetings there tomorrow. And maybe just a point on that, following on these consultations in Morocco, Libyan delegates are now traveling to Berlin.
These unity talks resume in the German capital and involve the five permanent UN Security Council members, along with Italy, Germany, Spain, and the EU. This is VOA News. A series of terror bombings killed at least 20 Tuesday in and around Iraq's capital, Baghdad, which is under threat by Islamic State militants. The most serious blast came when a car bomb blew up alongside the city's busy Palestine Street, home to numerous stores and restaurants. No one has claimed responsibility, but Islamic State has been behind similar attacks in the capital. The extremist group is taking responsibility for another strike Tuesday at a local government building in Amiryat al-Fallujah, west of Baghdad. At least 8 reportedly killed. An Egyptian court Tuesday sentenced 11 people to death over a 2012 football riot that killed more than 70 and injured hundreds. The court, trying more than 70 defendants, sentenced 40 to up to 15 years in prison and acquitted the rest. The retrial of the case, first tried in 2013, followed an appeal and an order from Egypt's Court of Cassation. The father of one of the victims, Abu Suleiman, said outside the courtroom, "There is no justice," and he pointed out a 5-year prison term handed down to Port Said security official described as the main cause of the disaster. The riot began at the end of a league match in Port Said between Cairo's Al Ahly and home team Al Masri, whose fans attacked Al Ahly supporters with knives, rocks, and clubs. Many were crushed trying to escape. Defense chiefs of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, Benin, and Chad Tuesday met in Abuja to discuss joint operations against the Boko Haram insurgency. Alex Bada is Nigeria's chief of defense staff.
Security is an issue that affects every nation takes very seriously, and the rise of extremism and terrorism across our region and indeed the world has made the issue even more pertinent.
Joint operations conducted since February have pushed the militant group out of most areas it controlled in northeast Nigeria. It is blamed for more than 15,000 deaths in the past 6 years. Meanwhile, the French press agency reports another 15 killed when Boko Haram fighters attacked the village of Huyum in Borno State. The UN human rights chief has warned that violence by pro-government militia in Burundi threatens to destabilize the country amid pre-election violence over President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial third-term bid. Zaid Raad al-Hussein, in a statement issued Tuesday, said the militia violence, including executions, abductions, and torture, could, quote, tip an already extremely tense situation over the edge. One of the world's largest banks, HSBC, is planning to cut up to 50,000 employees, place more focus on Asia, overhaul its global operations, and perhaps move its headquarters out of London. The job cuts affect nearly 20% of the staff over the next 2 years. HSBC operates more than 70 nations with thousands of branches, tens of millions of customers, and assets of more than $2.5 trillion. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, June 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. As African leaders meet this week in South Africa, analysts warn about the next flashpoint for conflicts on the continent.
If African leaders do not speak out early and decisively to stop the third dam debate in countries, the next cause of instability or war will be particularly the decision of leaders to hang on to power.
That's analyst David Zumanao. Nigeria's military relocates its command to the heart of Boko Haram insurgency. Zimbabweans vote today in parliamentary by-election that some say could test the ruling ZANU-PF party's support in urban areas. And Gambia's main opposition leader criticizes President Yahya Jammeh's government for expelling a European Union diplomat.
The EU has been our biggest development partner. To expel its representative from the Gambia so unceremoniously without any reason is really putting in danger our relationship.
Usainu Dabo is the leader of the opposition United Democratic Party of the Gambia. The death of a former Zimbabwe energy minister is described by one analyst as questionable. And a white U.S. policeman who drew his gun at mostly black teenagers resigns. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. African Union heads of state gathering this week for this year's African Union Summit in Johannesburg will discuss raging conflicts in Burundi, South Sudan, Mali, Nigeria, and other countries. Analysts say while the continental body has made some strides in dealing with conflicts, it needs to do more. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Women's empowerment is what the banners say outside the AU Summit, being held this week in Johannesburg. But as usual, conflict, both political and civil, is likely to dominate discussion as African heads of state meet for the twice-yearly summit. Analysts from the Institute of Security Studies gathered in Johannesburg Tuesday as AU officials met, behind closed doors, a few blocks away. Analyst Lisa Lovodrin says talk of ongoing conflicts and political standoffs are likely to dominate the event.
Basically, many of you have attended AU summits before. The theme often eclipsed by the more urgent peace and security issues.
This year, those include political unrest in Burundi as the longtime president attempts to run for a third term, political and ethnic conflict in the new nation of South Sudan, and the ongoing threat of Boko Haram insurgents in Nigeria. Add to that the older conflicts in Somalia, which hasn't had a stable government for more than two decades, Eastern Congo, which has been mired in miserable conflict since the 1990s, and the continuing fallout from the 2011 downfall of Libya's longtime leader. Analysts note that in recent years, the AU's Peace and Security Council has evolved into a more powerful organization than it was before, and has mobilized faster than ever before to react to conflicts. But analyst David Zumano says African leaders are not moving fast enough to counter one of the emerging trends on the African continent. Longtime leaders attempting to change their constitutions to hold on to power. That trend, he predicts, will be a key driver of future conflict.
I am of the opinion that the legal framework that we put in place is not helpful to stop the third term debate in countries. If African leaders do not speak out early and decisively against that attempt, because the next cause of instability or war will be particularly the decision of leaders to hang on to power.
But he noted things have improved since the AU was first founded in 1963. This year alone has seen unexpectedly peaceful transitions of power in formerly conflict-prone nations like Nigeria and Lesotho.
Seriously speaking, I think Africa has made some progress in the democratization process. I'm looking at Africa from 1960 to 2000 and counting almost 89 successful military coups as a way of changing power on the continent. Then I look at Africa from 2000 up to today and only realize we only have 6 military coups. That's a progress. Which means you have less presidents killed and you have less general coming to power. It also means that democracy has become the language in town.
The leaders begin meeting on Saturday. They will be led by the AU's current chairman, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, himself in power for more than three decades. Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, is not expected to attend. The last time he left his country, in May, a top general tried to overthrow him. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Nigerian military has moved its command post to the northeastern city of Maiduguri, the birthplace of the Boko Haram insurgency. Christine reports from BOA's regional bureau in Dakar on why this might be crucial to defeating the militant group.
It was President Muhammadu Buhari's first major announcement regarding the Islamist extremist group, which has ravaged the country's northeast in its six-year campaign to implement strict Sharia law. In his inaugural address last month, he announced that Nigeria's military command was to move from the capital Abuja to Maiduguri, the city where Boko Haram got its start and which they have repeatedly tried to overrun. Jan St. Pierre of the Berlin-based security firm Mosikon says it's a long overdue step for Nigeria's military.
This is a huge move. It's a very intelligent move and should have been done, in my opinion, a long time ago. It's only a temporary move, but it's a very smart one, and it's going to cut a lot of the bureaucratic decisions. It's going to speed up the process, and it's definitely going to be a boost to the soldiers knowing that the commanding officers are actually on site as well.
Mr. Buhari used the issue of Boko Haram to triumph over former President Goodluck Jonathan, under whose tenure the group was able to overrun huge swaths of the northeast. It was only in the months before the presidential elections last March that Nigeria, aided by troops from neighboring countries and foreign mercenaries, took back most of that territory. With his command staff now in the heart of the insurgency, Mr. Buhari should be more able to supervise the spending of money and the tactics employed by the soldiers, says freelance journalist and security analyst Al-Qasim Abdul-Qadir.
There was also really not much supervision as regards defense spending and also as regards the counterinsurgency strategy. So one thing that we might see here is the president being a former army general himself, you know, have an idea how these things are done.
President Buhari and his generals have their work cut out for them. Since his inauguration on May 29th, the group has carried out several attacks, including suicide bombings and rocket bombardments in Maiduguri. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Gambia's main opposition leader says the expulsion of the European Union's representative in the country is an ill-considered decision that could hurt the people of the Gambia. Agnes Gilao left Gambia Monday night after she was given 72 hours by the Yahya Jammeh government to leave. The government gave no reason for the expulsion, but opposition leader Usainu Dabo of the United Democratic Party of the Gambia says the EU has been one of Gambia's main development partners and the expulsion runs contrary to the interest of the Gambian people.
The decision of the government of the Gambia to expel the EU charge of affair is certainly the most ill-considered decision by this regime. It is putting our relationship with the EU at risk for no reason other than, I believe, the regime's intolerance to views that internationally unacceptable. The EU has been our biggest development partner. To expel its representative from the Gambia so unceremoniously without any reason is really putting in danger our relationship. I would have thought that whatever this diplomat might have done or might have said, the government of the Gambia should have protested to the EU rather than reacting in a way that is internationally unacceptable. This government has always been taking up wrong decisions, you know, on major foreign policy issues. You can recall our withdrawal from the Commonwealth. That was time that the UNDP resident rep was also declared persona non grata. Even the Chief Justice, you know, was also declared persona non grata.
Did the government give any reason for the expulsion?
It has not given any reason. And of course, I mean, this government is known for that, to take decisions without giving reasons for their decisions, because they very well know that whatever reason they advance would be very porous that no reasonable person would accept.
As you said, the European Union is one of the main economic partners of the Gambia. Do you think that worries President Yahya Jammeh, or that is something he should worry about?
Well, it's something that he should worry about, and I'm sure it's something that he worries about, but then he likes to show that I'm the tough guy, when in fact he's not the tough guy. And then really, you know, such decision, you know, runs contrary to the interests of the Gambian people.
Do you think he cares about the criticism from the outside? Because, as you said again, the government has done this.
He doesn't care. If he cares, he wouldn't have taken such a decision at all. And this is what we are telling the Gambian people, that Yahya Jammeh doesn't care about the Gambia. He doesn't care about the interests of the Gambia. I mean, he cares about his own personal ego. That's all. He wants to show that, look, I'm a tough guy. You know, I can deal with the European Union the way I want. I can deal with the United Nations the way I want. I can deal with the Commonwealth the way I want. And nothing, you know, will come out of it.
I know the government gave no reason why, but do you think the European Union diplomat must have criticized the government of Yahya Jammeh?
Well, you know, you have the, I mean, the political dialogue, you know, that is due to, I mean, take place. And of course, I mean, the EU, through its representative, has eloquently stated, you know, its position on the treatment of homosexual lesbians and so forth. And they have done that. And Yahya Jammeh, he is on a so-called moral crusade to combat homosexuals and lesbians.
Usainu Dabo is the leader of the opposition United Democratic Party of the Gambia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Banjul. Today's Wednesday, June 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Zimbabweans are voting today in parliamentary by-elections that some analysts say could test the ruling ZANU-PF party's support in urban areas. As Thomas Chiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports, the election is also expected to usher in a new development plan for the capital, Harare.
Many ZANU-PF supporters, like Colin Gadzamoyo of Glenview South, say the by-elections are a foregone conclusion as ZANU-PF will win against small party contestants and independent candidates because the ruling party's nemesis, the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, is boycotting the polls.
I think we're going to win because we've been winners for a long time. Since we're in power, we're still winners and we'll be winners and we are winners.
But Harare East registered voter Kudzai Sioka says this is not all about just romping to victory.
In the past, we haven't seen nothing much. For these guys who are coming in, we know there's Terence Mukupe from ZANU-PF, but we don't know what exactly he does. We just know he's a banker. His potentials, we would lie, we don't know much about him. But we need change in this area. We need to see development projects like we need roads to be repaired. We need many things here.
All MDC formations are boycotting the parliamentary by-elections as they are calling for electoral reforms before participating in any poll in the country. They claim that even the 2013 general elections were rigged in favor of President Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party. Mr. Mugabe's party has dismissed these allegations as far-fetched, labeling the MDC formation's stooges of the West. Kwazana-based MDCT supporter Mishek Mutero says ZANU-PF's victory will be insignificant.
How do you win in a race that you are running alone? It does not happen. The parties that are contesting that election do not have the broad representations from the people. And I'm also not sure if this will give ZANU-PF any legitimacy, because the victory for me is Pyrrhic. It doesn't make sense.
While ZANU-PF is approaching these polls with verve, political analyst Dumisani Nkomo of a non-profit organization, Habakuk Trust, believes that the ruling party is using the by-elections to settle its internal fights. Nkomo says, despite having a majority in parliament, the by-elections are also important in the battle to succeed 91-year-old President Mugabe.
Whichever faction has got the majority in the parliament will then nominate the person who then becomes president 90 days after the acting president has stepped down.
Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Still in Zimbabwe, former energy minister and deposed ZANU-PF provincial chairman for Harare, Amos Medzi, was Tuesday morning found dead in a vehicle on his farm. He had been linked to a faction of ZANU-PF believed to be led by former Vice President Joyce Mujuru. Police spokesman and senior assistant commissioner Charity Charamba declined to comment, but political commentator Nkululeko Sibana believes Mitzi is a victim of ZANU-PF factionalism.
What we want to know is what has led to this situation, if it happened without ZANU-PF's involvement, and if it happened with ZANU-PF's involvement, why did they have to do it this way? What has gone so wrong?
So now, in your own opinion, really, do you think that maybe ZANU-PF has got a hand here?
Well, we know that ZANU-PF has a history of eliminating its internal enemies using spurious and strange car accidents and so forth, including, you know, the death of the late General Mujuru, which involved a fire. So you have to, ZANU-PF has a history of stage managing accidents, if you like, and has not had that approach where they have to have people looking as though they've committed suicide or even forcing them to commit suicide, because that's the other side of the story. It may be that they had something huge on him and they said, well, we either take you out or you take yourself out. I think that it is highly possible, and because things are becoming very tricky and out of control for ZANU-PF, I think asking people or having people look like they committed suicide becomes the next best method other than the accidents, which a lot of people now believe to be pretty obvious, given that some of the ministers that some of the people along in government include the former intelligence ministers who know exactly what has to be done. I think this will be a new method that can be used to take out even former intelligence ministers.
Political commentator Nkululeko Sibana of Huddersfield University in London was speaking with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Police in the southern U.S. state of Texas are investigating the actions of an officer who threw an unarmed black teenage girl to the ground after being called to break up a pool party. With increased national scrutiny on how race and use of force are handled by law enforcement, activists are again crying foul over the latest case of what they see as excessive use of force. Victoria Mackey has more from Washington.
What started as a pool party in this town north of Dallas ended with handcuffs and drawn weapons. Community residents tried to shut down the party Friday, claiming the teens were not allowed at the pool. Then, the police arrived. One teen recorded video as Officer Eric Casebold of the McKinney Police Department tackled 15-year-old Dejeria Becton.
He told me to keep walking, and I kept walking, and then I'm guessing he thought we were saying rude stuff to him, and he grabbed me, and he, like, twisted my arm on the back of my back, and he shoved me in the grass. And he started pulling the back of my braids, and I was, like, telling him that he can get off me because my back was hurting really bad.
As with other allegations of excessive use of force caught on camera, different witnesses tell different stories. One woman who saw the incident defended the police.
They were just doing the right thing when these kids were fleeing and using profanity and threatening security guards.
Casebolt is now on administrative leave while the McKinney Police Department reviews what happened. Activists are calling for transparency and swift action in the investigation. Among them, the Texas branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, whose Satinder Singh spoke via Skype.
Allegedly, what the police have said so far is that the kids were trespassing, which is a crime, yes. But the question becomes, and this is part of what smart policing, community policing is this the best response at this time, right? Am I going to escalate the situation to the point where someone dies or I'm throwing a girl in a bikini on the ground and putting my weight on her, where I felt the need to draw a gun on kids in swim trunks?
Several teens were detained at the scene, but only one man was charged with interfering with police. Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. In Orange Africa Cup of Nations build-up matches, Uganda and Gabon drew a 1-1 in Kampala, while the Democratic Republic of Congo and Cameroon played to a 1-1 draw on Tuesday. Meanwhile, Namibia Brave Warriors seek to raise their standing in African football, starting with their Africa Cup of Nations qualifier this coming weekend. The Brave Warriors coach, Ricardo Manetti, explains how their landmark victory at the recent Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup inspires their vision.
The last time we really made an impact in COSAFA was during my playing days. And I feel very honored to have matched there to get to the finals and to do one better as a coach now than what I did as a player in lifting the trophy. And I feel very honored and blessed to be part of this project. We started this 2-3 years ago with the transition of bringing in new players, especially from our development structures.
Going forward now, you're facing the
Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. You'll also be playing in the CHAN, the Africa Nations Championships. Given this success, has the Namibia Football Association given you certain targets?
Well, you know, the first target is going to sound very, very different. I think the association is very interested in us improving our rankings, first and foremost, because when your rankings favorable, then you will get a favorable draw in order to qualify for things. If you look at COSAFA at the moment, we did it the hard way. We were ranked number 8 in COSAFA and we had to play in the group, while the other countries like Zambia, South Africa, Mozambique, they didn't play in the group stages. So the rankings is the first priority for us. That is our departure point, to keep the momentum going from COSAFA going into AFCON with this qualifiers, to keep the same momentum going. And we appreciate the respect that we're going to receive. To play as an underdog all your life, it is very difficult, you know. People don't give you the respect, they don't give you the time of day to say that you can achieve things. But this team, this time around, showed and proved a lot of people wrong to say that with good preparation and with a good vision, you can achieve things.
That was Ricardo Manetti, coach of Namibia's Brave Warriors, speaking in the South African capital, Tshwane. In New Zealand, Ghana and Mali clash in Wellington in the first knockout match, while Senegal face the Ukraine in Auckland at the men's FIFA Under-20 World Cup today, Wednesday. Finally, the Africa Women's Nations Volleyball Championship starts in Nairobi, Kenya today, Wednesday. The winner of the 11-day contest qualifies for the World Cup in Japan in August. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Owen in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Eritrea is dismissing a United Nations report that accused the country of systematic, widespread, and gross human rights violations. In a statement on Tuesday, the Eritrean Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the report is totally unfounded and devoid of all merit. It says the accusations are the continuation of a politically motivated campaign to undermine Eritrea's political, economic, and social progress, including in the area of human rights. Groups such as Human Rights Watch have long accused the Eritrean government of oppressing its own people. This week's report from a UN Commission of Inquiry said the government represses the rights to free expression, opinion, assembly, and religion. It says Eritreans accused of crimes are not given fair trials and are subject to arbitrary detention, solitary confinement, and labor camps. The commission said those wishing to leave the country are hampered by strict government controls on movement and a shoot-to-kill policy implemented by the military in border areas to prevent keep from fleeing. An Egyptian court sentenced 11 people to death Tuesday in connection with a 2012 riot at a soccer stadium in the northern city of Port Said that left 74 people dead and injured hundreds more. Egypt's worst case of soccer violence began at the end of a match between Cairo's Al Ahly and the home Al Masry team when local fans stormed the field and clashed with visiting fans. The court on Tuesday also sentenced 40 defendants to terms of up to 15 years while acquitting 20 people. The sentences can be appealed. That's it for this Wednesday, June 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want,
Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.